senseless, much more cruelly than at the wealthy and powerful. When the greenhouse floods struck, for instance, rich people could flee out of harm's way. They complained, of course. They wailed bitterly that they had to abandon their homes, their livelihoods, their possessions. But they escaped with their lives. Their children survived. In Bangladesh, millions drowned when the mighty rivers overflowed. In Brazil and Venezuela, and elsewhere in South America, torrential rains caused mudslides that swept away the shanty towns that the wretched poor had built out of packing crates and cardboard on the steep hillsides overlooking the gleaming cities of the rich. Even in the United States, it was the poor, trapped by poverty and ignorance in urban ghettos and migrant crop pickers' barracks, who stayed and suffered and died. Some trusted to their God to save them. Many climbed to their rooftops as the waters rose and waved piteously to the news media helicopters circling above them. Some of them huddled together in the rain like dumb animals, waiting for a miracle to save them. Almost all of them died. Of course, the greenhouse floods and the other climate catastrophes that struck the world played right into the hands of the new morality and all those other authoritarian regimes in other lands. With millions of families displaced when coastal cities flooded and the global electric power grid collapsed, people wanted, desperately needed, roofs over their heads, food in their bellies, jobs, order, and safety. Above all, they wanted safety. In America, the new morality provided all that for the wretched refugees. All you had to do was to ask them for their help, and then do what they told you. It took me a long time to understand what was happening in the schools. Ages, in fact. It all came at us a little bit at a time, like Eliot said about the fog creeping in on little cat's feet. I think it was Eliot. It was all so long ago. T.S. Eliot. I remember when I was a student, and we joked that the T.S. stood for tough shoes. Kids don't read Eliot anymore. They don't even read Dr. Seuss. It was years and years before I realized what was happening. It wasn't the fault of the new morality, but they capitalized on it. Oh, yes. They took smiling advantage of it and used it for their own purposes. It, in this case, was the slow, patient, inevitable dumbing down of the schools. Not merely the students, but the teachers, the administrators, all of us. We let them make things easier. The path to hell again. The overarching goal of education was to achieve equality. Overreacting to the centuries of racism's evils, we broke our hearts to achieve equality. Brilliant little Johnny is no better than the intellectually challenged Gloria. We mustn't let Tamiko lord it over Duane just because he's autistic. So what if Erwin has attention deficit disorder or Ernestine is a Down syndrome victim? We can't hurt their feelings by putting them in separate facilities with specialists to look after them. They deserve to be mainstreamed and attend school with everybody else. So does Millicent, who can't read at all, and Alejandro, who constantly disrupts the class with his outbursts of anger and violence. Mainstream them. Mainstream them all. Besides, mainstreaming is cheaper than building and staffing special facilities for our special needs children. Equality of outcome, that was our aim. Everyone was to be treated equally. Every student would finish school the equal to every other student. And what was the easiest way to achieve equality? Teach to the lowest common denominator. Make certain that every student got exactly what every other student received. No fast lane for the so-called bright ones. That wouldn't be equal. The mainstream spewed them out equally. year after year. Self-esteem. We tried to teach the kids to have pride in themselves. It took me years to figure out that for a youngster to have pride in herself, she had to be able to accomplish things, achieve something to be proud of. But somehow, we left that part out of the curricula. We stopped teaching T.S. Eliot because he was too difficult to understand. Shakespeare, too. And Hemingway, well, he used foul language and openly depicted sex. So we taught less and less of the things that made the kids feel unhappy with themselves, and spent more and more classroom time on teaching them self-esteem. Trying to drum arithmetic into their skulls only made them feel bad, so we eased off on the math, and the spelling, and the reading assignments, and homework. Nobody liked homework, especially the parents. We taught them self-esteem. By golly, we did. And then there were the pressure groups. Parents didn't want their kids exposed to political beliefs that went against their own politics. So we stopped teaching civics. When an activist group decided that the Declaration of Independence was a subversive document, with its ringing call for overthrowing a government that was deemed oppressive, we stopped teaching about the American Revolution altogether. Besides, Jefferson and Washington and the rest of the Founding Fathers were slaveholders, weren't they? Darwin. When I first started teaching, we were forbidden by the state legislature to use the word evolution in class. Then we stopped teaching biology altogether, and physics, and chemistry. Instead, we taught general science, including alternate concepts such as intelligent design and astrology. It was a lot easier on the children, and we teachers didn't have to defend ourselves against righteous parents who got blue in the face over godless, secularist ideas. We went along with it. The kids were happier, the pressure groups were happier. A few die-hard scientists and university academics warned that we were turning out a generation of ignoramuses, but they were happy ignoramuses, and we could keep our jobs and avoid all the painful conflicts. There were some kids who managed to get ahead anyway. Bright youngsters. A few. A precious few. A handful of schools managed to cater to those budding geniuses who thirsted for real knowledge. The country needed a certain number of engineers and scientists, after all. But they were always distrusted, carefully watched, their work closely controlled by the government and the new morality. Schools like MIT and Caltech were necessary, but kept under surveillance with a combination of jealousy and suspicion. The powers that be needed scientists and engineers, but they never trusted them. I knew it was wrong. I suspect most of the other teachers had their misgivings too. But you couldn't buck the tide, not if you wanted to keep your job, not if you wanted to live in the community you were teaching in. Nobody wanted to be branded a pariah, a heretic. So we ambled along down that sloping path to hell, and taught self-esteem to kids who knew less and less about more and more. Chapter 4. Tavallera marveled at how Stoner smoothly, effortlessly moved through Bishop Craig's staff. Receptionists, aides, security guards, executive assistants. He simply spoke to them for a few moments, and they allowed him to pass. They all seemed to be in a daze, Tavallera thought. It's like he hypnotizes them. He was standing with Stoner and Dr. Mayfair in an anteroom on the top floor of one of the buildings that adjoined the hospital. Through the sweeping floor-to-ceiling windows, Tavallera could see the complex of new morality buildings sprawling outside, with elevated walkways connecting the glass towers. Far below, parking lots stretched in all directions, the cars and buses looking like miniature toys from this distance. helicopters.